Want to say goodbye to your wireless carrier, but you can't? Either they trapped you in a long-term contract, or they've got you locked up paying off a phone. Sounds like a bad carrier relationship to us. T-Mobile can set you free. Now we'll pay off your phone up to $650 when you trade it in. Yep, every last cent. And if it's a contract holding you back, we'll take care of that too. How's that for a clean break? So get out of that bad carrier relationship. Just remember, it's not you, it's them. It's definitely them. Why wait? Ditch your carrier and their switching fees, and switch to the Uncarrier today.
Pay off with trade-in credit and Visa prepaid card. Eligible trade-in, new device purchase, qualifying credit and service required. May take up to 8 weeks. See a T-Mobile store for offer details. Promotion card issued by MetaBank. Member FDIC. Card expires.
Blog Talk Radio.
Now it's time for some mind, body, and soul food with host Tanya Parker.
One, two, here I go.
Well, I'm a hungry woman. Feed me like I want to be fed. Yeah, I'm a hungry woman. Feed me like I want to be fed. Well, you can feed my body, but you really gotta feed my head.
All right. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Mind, Body, and Soul Food. I am your host, Tanya Parker, here to dish up some deliciously delectable consciousness-raising creations for your mind, body, and soul. So you heard the wonderful Gaye Adegbolola, who brought us in with Hungry Woman Blues. Some of you may know her from her former group, Sapphire, the Uppity Blues Women. And certainly we hope to have the cure for the hungry woman and the hungry man blues on this show, where on second Sundays at 6, we serve up a big dish on natural and holistic healing to feed your mind, body, and soul. I'm going to briefly share with you a little bit about myself before we swing into the show. Spirit has called me to work within my practice and ministry, Mind, Body, and Spirit Works, to facilitate expression of one's highest self through divinely inspired and assisted holistic healing, teaching, coaching, and writing services. And over the last few decades, I can't believe I'm actually saying decades, my holistic table has served up a lot of different offerings, one of which is Mind, Body, and Soul Food, which is providing an opportunity each month to feed our listeners with mind, body, and soul-nourishing information as we give voice to the vision of truly gifted holistic healers and light workers. And I always like to thank you listeners out there who support and sustain the show. And I'm sending a special shout out to those who tuned in last month to hear our amazing guest, feng shui expert and author, Tess Whitehurst. And she shared insights on her new book, Magical Fashionista. I have to tell you, I was quite inspired. I started cleaning out my closet, and I found clothing I didn't even know was there. And the funny thing is, after going down some sizes, some of the clothing fit perfectly. So I didn't have to go out shopping for some items I thought I needed to. And I was able to gift some clothing to other folks as well. So tonight, we are in for another wonderful treat. I have to tell you, I have admired this guest and his work for so many years. He retired from general and pediatric surgical practice in 1989 and has since dedicated himself to humanizing the medical establishment's approach to patients and empowering patients to induce their own healing. So you know that's right up my alley with mind, body, and soul food. Without further ado, I'd like to extend a warm mind, body, and soul food welcome to one of my holistic healing heroes, Dr. Bernie Siegel. Welcome.
Thank you, Tanya. And your introduction, you know, talking about women, on my website, which is BernieSiegel, SiegelMD.com, I have an article entitled, What Does Every Woman Want? Because, you know, I've seen over the years women are the survivors, really. You know, they're the ones who show up to share feelings, what's happening in their lives, and so forth. And it's so hard to get the men to show up, even when they're, you know, confronting a life-threatening illness. And it's hard to get them to show up when the wife is. You know, they're into working and doing and not sharing. I mean, it's slowly improving, but it's a tough one. And I would just share with every woman out there, what does every woman want? A life of her own. So live your authentic life. Don't be mama. Don't be the wife, the housekeeper, the whatever. Because, you know, I've watched women, well, one woman in particular said, I can't die till they're all married and out of the house. She had 9 kids. And, of course, when did she die? 20 years later, when the last kid left home. And as a doctor, I have to say that what amazed me is, how did she manage the cancer for 20 years? You know, because she really lived well, looked well, and then boom. And, you know, I wish she had seen herself as her 10th kid and said, okay, now they're out of the house. Let me have my childhood and enjoy myself at this time. So please live. You know, every time I start talking, I keep thinking of stories because just one more, if you don't mind.
Oh, I don't mind at all. You're a master storyteller.
All right. This was a couple that were in real estate, and the wife did incredibly well. And the husband, you know, was thrilled because she made lots of money in their business. But she came in to our support group saying how her husband kept criticizing her. Not about work, see, but how you're dressed, what you made for dinner. I mean, all these things. And she was just getting worn out. You know, when she'd make money, oh, wonderful. But as soon as they'd get home, he'd start in again. And I said to her, then what I want you to do is next time he comes home, you're to be standing there naked. And when he says, what are you doing? Say, I never know what to wear. And then when he asks, what's for dinner? Say, I couldn't decide. You know, I mean, women have to understand they really have a lot of power.
Yes.
I don't know if you mind the next one, but I read this somewhere that really if women put their legs together and kept them there, they could take over the world. That was, can't remember who well-known person wrote that, but women need to realize they do have a lot of power and not to be, you know, the victim or the sweet, you know, young lady who's internalizing anger and not sharing feelings, because that sets you up for disease and trouble. And I always, if you ask an audience, I have twin sisters. One is a sweet little girl, internalizes anger, and spends all her time making mommy and daddy happy. And the other one's a devil who's driving everyone crazy. Who's more likely to get breast cancer? And, of course, everybody votes for the good girl. So there's nothing wrong with being good, but not in a submissive way. And I promise I'll pause after the next one. My wife and I were speaking, down south. And this was to a woman's group. There were hundreds and hundreds of women in the audience. And I was sensing hostility. I felt very uneasy, you know, after we were talking for a while. And I said to one of the women, what's going on here? I mean, the audience, it feels hostile. And she said, they're jealous of you and your wife. That your wife goes up on the stage, participates with you, can interrupt you while you're talking and correct you. They have lost track of politeness and are submissive, and so they're jealous of your wife. And that's the last point I'd make right now to the women. Don't be submissive. Being polite is fine, but being submissive is not. So you can love someone but not like their behavior and show appropriate anger.
Well, you are definitely speaking to my journey. I have to say that when you shared these messages in your book that we'll be discussing tonight, you were preaching to the choir, and they were resonating with me a great deal. And I'm really excited to get into it, the art of healing, uncovering your inner wisdom and potential for self-healing. And what a storyteller you are. Your book is chock full of stories. But I'm familiar with you, thankfully so, but some of our listeners are not, and I want to make sure that they know exactly who you are, because it's not often these days that we see someone who has had a successful surgical practice who now devotes himself to a different form of healing. So if you can share with us a little bit about your background and how you came along this journey.
I didn't know. I didn't have a normal upbringing. Because to summarize it, I was loved by my parents and grandparents. I got along with God. Religion was not, a problem or an issue. And I did well at school. So, I didn't know what other people were going through. And as a matter of fact, in my first book, and first two or so, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, Peace, Love, and Healing, where I ask people questions about their life to understand why they might be vulnerable at a certain time, and might get sick at a certain time, doctors were saying to me, "You're blaming your patients." I said, "What are you talking about? You're asking them what happened last year to in their life. So it's like it's their fault they got sick." I said, "No, I'm trying to empower them. I mean, if they've had a loss, of a life of a loved one, their job moved, that the change, loneliness. See, all these things now are shown to have genetic effects from laughter to loneliness. So it's a lot more scientific than it was 30 or more years ago when I began talking. And the reason it happened, yes, I became a doctor for what I called healthy reasons. I like people. But then I didn't know what to do with the pain, all the things you can't cure and fix. And I did a lot of children's surgery. And, oh boy, when you watch what children are going through, you really begin to question, why would God make a world like this? I mean, things that you're not talking about in medical school or surgical training. But you really begin to question the nature of life and creation and a whole host of things. And what altered my life, while attending a meeting I thought was for doctors by Dr. Carl Simonton, who wrote a book, Getting Well Again, and was teaching cancer patients how to do imagery and things of this sort, it sounded to me like here's a conference for doctors. I'll go. It can help empower me, give something more to my patients. I was the only doctor out of 125 people in the room. There were a couple of therapists, and everyone else was a cancer patient. And a rare male, I'll tell you, if there were any in the room, I don't even remember any. But my patients then weren't separated from me, and they all came over and sat down next to me. And one young woman with breast cancer, and I keep saying, I just wish she would hear me one night and say, "Hey, it was me," and show up back in my life. Because she said to me, "Bernie, you're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me, so I need to know how to live between office visits."
Mm.
And that really changed my life. It was fascinating.
Profound.
This was a weekend workshop. When I came back to the office on Monday, my surgical partner looked at me and said, "You're gone." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You're a different person than you were on Friday. You're going to leave surgery." I looked at him. I said, "You're nuts. I don't know what you're talking about." 8 years later, he was right. I quit, and I went off full-time, counseling people and lecturing and teaching. But what I did in the beginning was start support groups, thinking hundreds of people would show up, because I sent 100 letters to people with cancer saying, "You want to live a longer, better life, come to a meeting." And less than a dozen women showed up. But they became my teachers, and why I became a storyteller, so I didn't end up arguing with doctors. If I told stories, they didn't feel threatened. It's an anecdote, it's a case history. But because when I first started talking in a scientific way, they got mad at me. That's not well controlled. It's a poor journal. It just got crazy. So I became a storyteller so we wouldn't fight with each other and they wouldn't be afraid to tell me if they met a story. And then the dialogue would begin and their minds were open. I mean, the oncologists in town, a large group, sent me a note saying, "Come to our office. We want to talk to you." And I thought, isn't this wonderful? They're going to compliment me for running support groups. Well, what they did was start yelling and criticizing me. And I sat there with a smile thinking, "Oh, I'm such an idiot."
that was their version
thinking
of
they're going
an
to tell
intervention.
Me I'm wonderful. Yeah, and they said to me, "Why are you smiling? We're telling you all these things you shouldn't be doing. You're not a psychiatrist. You could hurt people." And I said, I'm smiling because I thought you would tell me what a wonderful person I am. But I have to tell you, they became some of my biggest supporters because at least, again, we had a chance to talk. So when I would have a patient who needed an oncologist, I'd send it to them. And they began to realize, you know, what I called in an affectionate way, Siegel's crazy patients, that they did exceed expectations. I mean, there was one that my father-in-law had injured his spinal cord in a fall. He had a home health aide who, I didn't even know this, but she said later, she told her cousin from North Carolina to come up here because the doctor told her not to bother to go to Duke. She's going to die anyway. And why go through all the chemotherapy and the traveling and et cetera? So she said, I told her to come up here because you get people well all the time. And believe me, if I had known ahead of time, I probably would have said, look, I can't promise anything. Maybe you shouldn't. Mm-hmm. But up she comes. Admitted to the hospital. She had leukemia. So I said to her, this is not, you know, a surgical disease. I'll get my oncologist friend to come over. And I sat on the bed. We talked for a while, gave her big hugs, and, you know, then left. And got a call from my oncology friend. And he said, Bernie, I agree with her doctor. But I know your patients. I'll give her hope. And then, and I'm sure I put this in one of my books, I began getting letters from him that she was doing well, very well, extremely well. And the last letter said she's in complete remission. And she went home perfectly well. What did I hear later from the nurse's aide? Oh, you sat on her bed and hugged her. She knew she'd get well then. Now, you know, think of how powerful her beliefs were. And, you know, as far as I was concerned, it had nothing to do with the hug. It had to do with her believing, you know, that the treatment would be good. But if that shaped her frame of mind, it changes her chemistry. You know, think of when one doctor tells you, go home and die, and the other one offers you, you know, hope and a cure, the difference within you. And we know this literally, that you can study actors when they're reading a script about a tragedy versus reading a script about a comedy. And I mean, they're just reading a script. But if you draw their blood, and this was done while they're reading the different scripts, while they're reading a comedy, their immune function improves and their stress hormone levels go down. And while they're reading the tragedy, the immune function goes down, stress hormone levels go up. So you see how important it is that doctors be trained in how to speak to people. Yes. I always say, listen to the commercials on television. If all you were told were the problems that go with a certain medication, you'd never take it, you know, or you'd have every problem induced by it because it's hypnotic to hear that from a doctor. At least they start with it could cure your headache, you know, before they tell you it can kill you in a variety of ways. But
in a lot of different ways, that's for sure.
You know, and if doctors just tell you the side effects, you know, here's your treatment, here are the side effects, why don't we say this could cure you, this can make you, you know, improve your life, give people some positive image. Well, another one of my articles is deceiving people into health. Now, that may sound crazy, but I learned that there's no reason to not lie to people if it was good for them. You know, like somebody hypnotizing you, if you know what I mean. And particularly, as I said, I did a lot of children's surgery. And I realized from the kids, I wasn't thinking of lying to them. I realized that they were misinterpreting my words. And the one that really woke me up was very simple. Child's in the emergency room with appendicitis. You want to, you know, reassure them. So I would tell them what's going to happen. You'll go up to the operating room. You will go to sleep when you go in the operating room. I'm thinking of anesthesia, so they won't be afraid, that they won't have any pain. But what I realized was the children, many of them, fell asleep when we wheeled them into the operating room.
Fascinating.
And, you know, and their comment to me was, you told, well, one boy, because I had a laugh, because he flipped over on his stomach. He had appendicitis. And went to sleep. So I picked him up to turn him over, and he started screaming at me. I said, why are you yelling at me? He said, you told me I would sleep. I sleep on my stomach. Now, everybody in the operating room is laughing, but I realized, wow, think of the impact my words had on him, you know, and how literally he took it. And so I paid attention to what I said and how I said it to people.
You have so many wonderful, amazing stories in the book that, you know, the anecdotal evidence that really, really hits home about our inner ability to heal.
Hmm.
Now, you use the term, you refer to yourself as a Jungian surgeon.
Oh, yes.
And can you explain why, you know, I'm a former psychotherapist, so I spent a good deal of time studying Carl Jung. So, Jungian surgeon, what is that?
Why that happened? I drew a picture for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross many years ago, you know, going to her workshops to help me deal with my pain. Well, as an aside, I may say that think of Jack Kevorkian, what might have happened if he went to a Elizabeth Kubler-Ross workshop instead of killing people. You know, maybe he would have learned how to help people, you know, and run a hospice instead of that. Well, I wanted to help people. And what was amazing, Elizabeth asked me to draw a picture, and I drew an outdoor scene that I created for my meditation and imagery. And she began to question me about my life. Why is 11 important? What are you covering up? And all these were pertinent questions. I've been doing this 11 months. I asked her, what do you know about me covering up? Because it was all my feelings. She said, Bernie, this is a white piece of paper. You took a white crayon and made snow on a mountain. You didn't need the white crayon. You added a layer. What are you covering up? And by the time we were done, I thought, my God, how does she know all this about my life from this meaningless drawing? But it isn't meaningless. So I went back to the hospital with a box of crayons, you know, and I got patients to draw pictures. And I saw them providing me with their diagnosis, showing me anatomy as well as emotional. And I was so impressed with what I was discovering, see. Now, why did I think I was discovering it? Because nobody had ever taught me any of this.
Right.
And I sent articles to medical journals. It came back. Interesting, but not appropriate for this journal. So I sent it to where it was appropriate. And guess what? It came back again. Except this time the letter said, yes, it's quite appropriate, but it's not interesting. We know this. And those were psychotherapy journals. And I may add, you see, the psychiatrists had written books. The Will to Live, You Can Fight for Your Life, because they had seen patients be transformed in therapy and had the disease go away, or instead of dying in 2 months, you know, living 5 or 10 years. And Carl Menninger, the psychiatrist, I sent him my first book for his comments. He wrote back saying, Bernie, I was about to write a book called 10 Hopeless Cases. 10 people, all of whom are supposed to be dead, alive, and well today. But I'm not going to because you just wrote it. Now, that blew my mind, see? Doctors are criticizing me, and he's telling me, yes, I was going to write your book. But again, it's the sad part of medicine that I always say, it's like having a problem in your house. Think of the human body as your house. So if you have a plumbing problem, you get a plumber. Electrical, you get an electrician. You know, the roof, you get the roofer. They don't know what the other guys are doing. And that's what's happened to medicine. We've become so specialized, we don't treat the whole person and their experience. And that's what I learned to do, treat their experience and what a difference it then made. And I began to run into Jungian therapists, literally, some who even knew Jung, Susan Bach. I mentioned these books in my book, who lived into her 90s and knew Jung. And she said to me, he was fascinated by the somatic aspects in the drawings. And I used to bring her drawings. She was in London, that would show her the body in a drawing, you know, certain parts of anatomy. And I said, you don't see the anatomy because you don't know anatomy. But Jung was a doctor. He was trained. He knew it. And so I began to read Jung and find that he interpreted a dream like 90 years ago or so and diagnosed a brain tumor. Now, why aren't doctors told that? I literally have never met a doctor who ever heard that while they were in training. Now, it seems to me we ought to say that. So you would ask your patient, do you have a sense of what's going on? Have you had any dreams? Here, draw a picture for me. Because the body speaks to us through dreams and images. So it can't talk. I was just reading, as a matter of fact, it's a bit of research, because, see, I'm always saying the reason we sleep is to be in touch with this wisdom. But some scientists were saying the brain also nourishes itself during sleep. More fluid accumulates in it, and nourishment comes in. It's like repairing itself. And I thought, that's amazing. They're saying the same thing in a physical sense that I was saying in a psychological sense, that in the evening, when the body is quiet, your intellect is still, the brain repairs itself. And I think it's also repairing itself, both psyche and soma, both body and soul, so to speak. So both parts are presented to the person and can be repaired. Now, obviously, it's easier in a mechanical repair because a lot of people say, oh, I can't remember my dreams. Yeah, if you keep a lid on your unconscious and your feelings, you won't remember or be aware of your dreams either. But when you take the lid off and say, yes, I'm going to do meditation and imagery and pay attention to these things, then your consciousness knows you're ready and it presents things to you. And I always say to people that when you have a dramatic dream, believe me, you'll wake up and know it. You know, that, you can have, like watching a movie sometime and it's interesting, but you don't remember when you wake up because it's no big deal. But when some dramatic issue comes up related to, well, we have another book called The Book of Miracles because of things happened. A lady goes to sleep. Into her dream comes a dark-skinned woman with an accent who tells her that she has a lump in her breast and needs to have it evaluated in her right breast. The woman wakes up, feels it, goes to the hospital next day. They diagnose it as breast cancer, and they tell her the doctor who's going to take care of her and direct her treatment will be coming in a few minutes. Into the room walks the woman from her dream. It's a doctor from India, female, with an accent. Now, you know, I could say to you, tell me how that happens. But I know it happens because our consciousness, well, a Jungian statement, you see, the future is unconsciously prepared long in advance and therefore can be guessed by clairvoyance. So when you go and get your fortune told, they're reading your consciousness and telling you about the future. And you can do it in a drawing or a dream. I mean, you don't have to go to somebody. You do the drawing and we can help you interpret it. You'll see, because there's past, present, and future in the dream and in the drawing.
So when you have your medical histories, it's fascinating. You certainly have been a pioneer with this, in that you're including in the history information about dreams, and you're providing them with crayons and other means to draw a picture that has been so helpful in diagnosis and treatment for your patients.
Yeah. Let me give people I was going to give you an example that, if you wanted me to, just...
moment, I would love to hear the example. I just want to remind folks to call in if they have a question to 917-889-7806. We have Dr. Bernie Siegel here talking about his latest book, The Art of Healing, Uncovering Your Inner Wisdom and Potential for Self-Healing. Make sure to follow the prompts to listen to the host, to speak to the host, and I believe that's just touching the number one, and we'll take your call. So, Bernie, if you can tell us your example.
Yeah, I mean, a simple one. I think it's in the book, but I can't remember. There's 70 drawings in the book, and I have probably thousands by now. But a mother came in with a young child, and she said, I'm afraid my daughter has lymphoma. She has a lot of large lymph nodes in her neck, and it runs in our family. And she said, my daughter drew some pictures for you, because everybody began to know I love pictures, so they would draw them. Matter of fact, the operating room made up a coloring book for the kids because they became so impressed, see, that Siegel starts out crazy, and then they all were so fascinated by the drawings that they made a coloring book for the kids to reveal things, and I can mention that in a minute. But anyway, the young girl handed me her first picture, and it's a picture of herself with a big swollen neck and jaw. Then the second picture was a big cat with large claws. And I said to the mother, "Don't worry." She said, "What do you mean, don't worry?" I said, "Your daughter has cat scratch fever. Look at this cat. Look at those claws." And we removed a lymph node. I mean, you know, my wife always says, "Honey, tell people that you also operate on them so they don't sue you because you just looked at a picture." You know, but yes, we went ahead and took one of the nodes out, and it was indeed an infection from cat scratch fever. But, I mean, I can tell you when I looked at that picture, I just knew. Now, another, in this book that the operating room made, at the bottom of each page was a paragraph of, you know, discussion, so the kids would know what was going to happen. And the first page, you see the child sitting on the operating table, all the equipment, the anesthesiologist, and it said, the anesthesiologist is wearing what looks like green pajamas. And then it goes on. There's no color, you know, because we gave them crayons to fill in everything. But here it clearly says that the anesthesiologist is wearing green pajamas. The child picks up a red crayon and draws the anesthesiologist wearing red. When he did that, I said to the anesthesiologist, I said, "He knows there's a danger here." And the anesthesiologist said, "Yes, his mother has muscular dystrophy. He can have an adverse reaction to the muscle relaxants, cause contractions, send the temperature of the body up, and injure his brain." I said, "Then look at the last page. If he draws himself purple, a spiritual color, I'm just going to cancel the case. I'm not going to take a chance." And we looked at the last page, and the boy drew his clothing, which he wasn't wearing, in red and black. So I knew he was basically saying, "I'm not happy, I'm hurting, you know," but he'd be going home, I knew that, and not dying in the operating room. So we went ahead. But those are the amazing things that you'd see. People, somebody's in the emergency room, everybody's yelling, "Operate, operate." This man had severe abdominal pain. I said, "Draw me a picture while I wait for the lab test." He drew his abdomen with a green color. That's a natural, healthy color. Didn't fit. So I said to everybody, "I'm going to watch him, going to observe him." "Oh, you're crazy." But, you know, because he had what was called a board-like abdomen. I mean, it hurt him so much. If you pushed on his abdominal muscles, they were like boards. I mean, you could stand on it. I mean, because he was in such pain, how tight they were, so nobody would hurt him. And after the young man knew, you know, me, you know, that we developed a relationship while I was observing him, he told me he was a drug addict, and he knew he was having a drug reaction, but he was in such pain he needed to come to the emergency room to get help. But he didn't want to tell anybody he was an addict. But, you know, when he felt comfortable and safe with me, then the truth came out, and because of his drawing, it saved him from having surgery, which would have done him no good at all.
Now, you mentioned, you've been mentioning colors, and I know you were referring to the purple, which, you know, as a Reiki master, I think in terms of the color of Reiki, the color of the crown chakra, spiritual connection, but also you were speaking in your book about the meanings of different colors, and that purple can be that spiritual connection. It could also have another meaning. And if you could talk a little bit about what colors used in the drawings mean.
I mean, the purple can be, I'm going to become a spirit as well as be a spiritual human being. So there are people who have, you know, purple, let's say, clothes on, and they are spiritual. But then there are others who draw themselves in purple or a purple kite or balloon going up in the sky, and they're saying, "I'm going to become a spirit. It's related to my death." But it's always a spiritual transition, if you know what I mean. That you know, they may not be happy that they're dying, but it's this transformation that they're going through, and that they will go through it in a spiritual way and become a spirit. I mean, one woman with cancer drew her husband flying a purple kite, and I said to her, "You're ready to go. He can't let go." So she said, "Let's get him in here." And he came in. And he said, you're right. My wife's a nurse. She pays the bills, makes the meals, takes care of everything, all the pets. If she dies, I'm dead. I don't know how to do a damn thing. And she said, honey, I won't die. I'll train you. And she spent 6 months training him. And he came in one day and said, honey, I cut the string. If you need to go, it's okay. And she said, I'll die Thursday when the kids get here from California. See, but that drawing made such a difference in their life. And again, there are times I don't tell people you're going to die, if you know what I mean. I'm not trying to depress
them. Right, right.
But, you know, when a child, well, here's a four-year-old who draws a purple balloon going up in the sky with her name in it, draped in black, and then some pretty colorful dots all around it. Now, what was interesting, lower on the same piece of paper, there's a yellow and green face crying. Now, that's energy, a natural color, and I thought, this doesn't fit. I mean, she's saying, I'm ready to go, and then it looks so healthy. And she said to me, that's not me. That's the kid in the next room crying. Boom. Now, how does she know to change colors? You know what I mean? This is an intuitive, unconscious wisdom. But what happened, I said to her mother, take her home. You've been through so much. Take her home and love her. And she did.
Yeah.
Then I got a phone call. Bernie, today's my birthday. Amber woke up and said, Mom, I'm dying today as a gift to you to free you from all the trouble. And the colorful dots on the page, we then realized, were the days left in her life. And I have her picture hanging in my hallway, you know, where the bedroom is, because her mother gave it to me as a gift. And that child was such a teacher to her mother. You know, I always say the only way to be immortal is through love. And little Amber is very much still alive because of the love and the relationships that she created, even as a four-year-old. You know, she did more, as do many kids with their lives, than we do, even though we may live 50 more years than they do.
Yes. You know, your book is chock full of beautiful photos. I mean, just amazing interpretations. So much information that you've been able to glean from the drawings that people have made. So I'd love for folks to be able to get the book and take a look at some more of the drawings and see exactly what you're talking about, because it's just full of so much imagery there. We have a caller who's been holding, and Bernie, I have to tell you, it's been a couple of months since my mom has called in, but I know that this is her number, or at least someone in her household. So, caller, you're on the line from the 804 area code. Do you have a question for Bernie?
I have had such a wonderful evening listening, and I there's so many questions in my mind, but I just thank you, Tanya, for insisting that I listen today, and I've done nothing but listen since I got off the phone talking to your sister-in-law. However,
okay.
There are just so many questions, but I just...
We're going to give you one.
Color purple. Okay.
Okay.
Color purple. That sort of fascinates me. I had never considered that, you know, spiritual... you know, I didn't know the significance of it and so forth. So that's very interesting. And just there's so many things in just listening to the interview, so many things that sort of blow my mind. You know,
well, you know, let me interrupt a minute, because what you get out of this is what is within you. I say this to people all the time. See, I can be your coach, but if you don't have the talent, then my coaching is not going to accomplish anything. So when you're willing to show up for practice, willing to listen, then special things happen. But I always look for people who think I'm wonderful, because I know they're wonderful. See, if they say you're inspiring, the inspiration is in them. I'm just bringing it out. And that's the key.
All right. The dream part, that's something so often... I know I dream something, it doesn't hold, I can't hold it, I can't remember it. And now, this is bringing, you know, it just, I had a dream last night, and I remembered it this morning, and I'm going to have to watch that dream.
Yeah, Or you can put,
so
you know, put a pad and pencil next to the bed. So if you wake up remembering it, write it down. Because if you go back to sleep, by the time the morning comes, you may not remember. But I'd say write it down, and then you can interpret it.
All right.
Wonderful. All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Ma. Enjoy the rest of the show.
And let me say this, as a mom or a dad, I used to laugh because our kids knew I was interpreting drawings. We have five kids. And, you know, you'd walk past their bedroom and they were sitting at a desk drawing a picture. And as soon as they'd see me, they'd slump over the picture so I couldn't interpret it. You know what I mean? They didn't want me to know what they were thinking. But when they had a problem, they'd come to me. But I really tell this to families because I've seen what I learned when you go into third grade and fifth grade and say, draw your home and family, it's tragic. 70% of them don't look like a family. You know, they're all over the place. Nobody's touching anybody. So ask your kids. What you tell them is, I want to put a picture on the refrigerator of our family. So draw our home and family. And then look at it. Are you touching each other? Do you have a nose to breathe life? Do you have ears to listen to each other? You know, are you all, is daddy at work, mom in the kitchen, the brother's in the bedroom, I'm in the front yard? I mean, you know, take a look at it and what's going on. And I may add, I was just thinking of one woman who the night before surgery drew herself with this great big smile. But one of her arms was longer than the other, and she put her child in it with his arm going out of the picture. And I said, I asked the picture of yourself. Why is the child there? Oh, he's a part of me. Why is your arm longer and his arm out of the picture? Oh, we're reaching for my husband. He's never there when you need him. But if you saw the smile on her face in the picture, see, don't deny the feelings. And through the drawings, you're able to bring out these things instead of keeping them buried in your body where they will do damage. And believe me, our life is stored in our bodies. The memories are there. So any painful ones, bring them forth so they don't do damage.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you so much for that wisdom and that reminder. And thank you so much, Ma, for calling in. We have another caller.
Okay. Thank you. Love you.
All right. We have another caller from the 202 area code with the 529 exchange. Do you have a question for Bernie?
Yes. Good evening, Professor. This is Karen.
Hi, Karen.
The 11 o'clock class. How are you?
All right. Glad to hear your voice. Great. Thanks.
Hi, Doctor. Hi. Eagle, how are you?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, what I wanted to know is that sometimes when you dream, you know, when I dream, sometimes I remember some things, and the dreams that I want to remember, I can't remember. Is it a reason for that, or?
Well, I think that, yeah, I mean, sometimes there is something in the dream that is disturbing you, if you know what I mean, and you're not ready to deal with it.
Okay.
And that's why I say, I call it taking the lid off. Let your unconscious know, even before you go to bed at night, say, I'm ready for any dreams, any information. I want to remember. I want it to help me. So, because if it's like a monster chasing you or something you're afraid of, it's easier to, you know, keep it locked up in a cave and not have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you keep, you know, working at it, believe me, it'll ultimately come through.
Okay.
And the other is always think about how you would interpret what's in the dream, meaning that you don't necessarily need a therapist. I mean, if you describe, like if I was in your dream, see, and somebody said, who's that? What's he? And then you had to describe me, that might tell you why I showed up in the dream, see?
Oh, okay.
So always think to yourself, if something strange comes up, how would I describe this? And then learn from the words that come out of you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it's what you're experiencing that becomes significant. And to you, because it's always very personal. You know, it's not somebody else. That's why what I like to do is share with people what certain symbols may mean, rather than say, oh, this means this, this means that. I present things to them and then give them a chance to think about why they drew something in a certain way. You know,
okay.
like if they don't have arms, what
okay.
would that mean? So, you know, always look at it in that way, too. If there's
mm-hmm.
something in the dream that seems strange, say, how would that affect me? What
uh-huh.
would, you know, what would that do to me? And then it begins to clarify what the dream means.
Okay.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you so much.
All
and
right.
I will be getting that book because it seems very, very interesting.
It's a
yes.
great,
something
great
that could
read.
Help
and, you know, the other thing about, I tell people with all books,
mm-hmm.
when you read a book and you get something out of it, read it again a year or two later.
Okay.
Because the book should get better if you're changing. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? If you become wiser and more informed, then you'll notice things in the book a year later you didn't notice the first time.
Okay.
And I noticed that myself listening to lectures in the car, you know, when you're taking a trip or reading the same book.
Uh-huh.
And I realized this is getting better. And I thought, you know, it isn't the book or the talk. It's me that I'm hearing things that I didn't hear or, you know, things I didn't see the first time. So
uh-huh.
I always mark books, and then when I reread it, I know if it's something I didn't see the first time.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling in, Karen.
Okay.
All right.
All
bye-bye.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now, you've talked about different forms of healing, of ways we can access healing, of things that impact our health. And, you know, being someone who focuses a lot on throat chakra healing, communication, expression, you have a chapter in the book where you're talking about words can kill or cure. Can you share with our listeners a bit more about that?
Yeah. One of our children has an art project. I mean, he was at school in an art class. And God knows, well, I think it's related to past lives and a whole host of things. But what he did was take the canvas that they were given and he wrote the word words on it over and over across the canvas. And when he brought it in the door to the kitchen that day, came home from school, telling us his teacher didn't think it was anything special. He didn't get an A. But I looked at it, I said, the teacher doesn't know what she's talking about. Because when you write words, 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 words with no space, they become swords, 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 swords.
Mm.
And that's hanging on the wall in our house. Because it said to me, Bernie, you can kill a cure with words, you can kill a cure with a scalpel. And it was quite a message. And that's why I say we need to be trained to use words in the proper way. You see,
yeah.
I mean, like endless stories that due to medical errors, I won't go into all the details, people who were supposed to be receiving chemotherapy, radiation, were not. Machine repaired, as I say, a medical error where they didn't, you know, put the treatment together properly and so forth. The doctors did not know they weren't treating people. That's how I heard these stories, because they came to me to say, oh, God, I feel terrible. I haven't treated anybody in a month. I said, what are you telling me? And he told me this story. See? I said, you don't realize what you're telling me. He said, what do you mean? I'm telling you I feel awful. I said, excuse me. You're not a dumbbell. So all of these patients thought they were being treated and therefore had shrinking tumors and side effects of the treatment they thought they were getting. And that doctor's eyes almost popped out of his head because he said,
powerful.
Oh, my God. Yeah, oh, my God, you're right. That's how powerful people's beliefs are. You
yes.
think you're getting a treatment, and you act as if you are. And that's why I say what we say to people, you know, creates either a benefit for them or trouble for them by how we present things and what we say to them. You know, it's okay to tell people there are side effects, but you start out with, this can make you well, cure you, prolong your life, and there are side effects, but not everybody has them. And you can list them. I often tell people, give the list to your family. So if you have a headache, you can say, is that on the list? If it isn't, you got a headache. You know, it's not your treatment. Because, again,
right.
I know people who have visual problems and asked their family to get a treatment for them. And the family gave them the wrong pill at home, but it cured their problem. You know what I mean? Like 4 or 5 hours mm-hmm. of nausea, it's gone, and you're feeling great. And then mm-hmm. when you have your glasses on or able to see, you say to your daughter, what are you giving me? This is the wrong medication. This is my anticoagulant. And your daughter says, well, it helped you last time. I mean, that's the truth. I don't make up any of these stories, you see. And so, again, when I say deceiving people, I say to parents, look, your child is going to be going through things with side effects. So what we're going to do is take a bottle of vitamin pills and label it. So whatever problems come up, you know, hair growing, anti-nausea, whatever. When your child has, I'm having a problem, here, we got that pill for you, see? They believe mm-hmm. in me, mm-hmm. they believe in their parents. And you yeah. could say, if that didn't work, fine, we got a stronger pill for you and give them some, you know, medication. But mm-hmm. It's amazing, as I said, with the kids, because they have faith in their parents and their doctor, and
yes.
it's hypnotic.
Yes.
As well as, you know, you can cause them trouble as well as you can cause them improvement, you know, if you scare them. And I may add, you know, to get back to the colors, that mm-hmm. they all have meaning. And that's why the rainbow, what's his name, Solzhenitsyn, in his book Cancer Ward, uses the word self-induced healing. See, I want people to understand it's our potential. It's built into us. I can't guarantee it to anybody. It's up to the person. All I can do is coach them. But I keep the work up because I know what happens. And so I know it's worth my doing this. But he used the term a rainbow-colored butterfly. And when I read that in his book, Cancer Ward, I thought, God, he knows all that I'm talking about. The rainbow is your life in order. The butterfly is a symbol of transformation.
Yes.
So what he's saying to, you know, this is all the men in the ward, was that transform your life, find order, and amazing things happen. And he uses the term self-induced healing, see? And mm-hmm. no doctor ever uses that term. We talk about
right.
spontaneous remissions and miracles, but you don't learn from them. But you
right.
would learn from self-induced healing. And that's why when I began to meet patients from our office that I thought were dead, you know, they hadn't returned to the office, and I'd meet them sitting in the audience at my lectures, I'd run over and say, what are you doing here? Why didn't you come back to the office? You know, well, nobody gave me any hope. What's the point? They would always have a story. I mean, just so people know, it doesn't have to be that profound. A gentleman looked like he was going to die in a few months. And it was somebody I was quite close to in our support group. And he said, I'm going to Colorado to die in the mountains. It's so beautiful there. I said to him and his family, call me. I will come out to the funeral. He means a lot to me. A year goes by, no phone call. So I called the family to tell them how angry I am that they ignored my feelings. The man answered the phone. I said, I called to get mad at your family. What are you doing? He said, it was so beautiful here, I forgot to die.
Wow.
See, I have a lot of letters like that that end with, mm-hmm. I didn't die, now I'm so busy, I'm killing myself. Help, where do I go from here? I mean,
right,
that's an exact
right.
quote from a lady who agreed with her doctor that she had 2 months to live. So, of course, she went home to enjoy the 2 months and did all kinds mm-hmm. of things. But don't wait, you know. I keep saying to people, we're all mortal. You know, that's why when we're on, like I'm talking to you, in some moment to get me to stop talking, you'll say, Bernie, we're running out of time. And to me, that's the message. Yeah, that's the message of life. You know, we're all going to mm-hmm. run out of time. So enjoy your lifetime. Don't fight a battle. Mother Teresa said it very well. I will not attend an anti-war rally, but if you ever have a peace rally, call me. So heal
yes.
your life. Find peace. Don't fight a war, because then you empower your enemy.
Yes, yes, I believe in that. Now,
yeah,
Bernie,
I use
we
the
are
word
running
eliminate.
Out of...
Okay.
Oh, well, I just want to pause for a moment. We have another caller, and I wanted to fit one more caller in before our time is up for this evening.
All right.
So this caller is from the 646 area code. Caller, do you have a quick question for Bernie?
Yes, I do. Thank you very much for taking my call. Am I on the air?
Yes
you are. You're on the air.
This is Yusuf, and I want to bid a good evening to you, Dr. Parker and Dr. Siegel. But the question I had is, we dream in REM sleep. So people who have apnea, how do we ever get to dream, much less to have our dreams interpreted? And can we rejuvenate our bodies? What means will we have, or are we just out of luck?
Yeah, no, what you can do, because I would see that just as I would with somebody who says, I'm going to have an operation, and they draw a horrible picture. They're in a black box with nobody taking care of them. What I say to them is, go home and visualize it as happening the way you want it to happen. See, having surgery, waking up, feeling fine, going home quickly, free of pain, etc. So I would say to you, whatever goal you want, keep visualizing 4 and 5 times a day. Then your body thinks it's really happening, see? So you retrain yourself. Because what you, I mean, the comment I always make to people, I mentioned about how actors, you know, it changes their blood. So act and behave as if you're the person you want to be, and rehearse and practice. And by using the imagery, seeing yourself, whether it's going to sleep or to work or anything else, that everything happening the way you want it to happen. I'm going to sleep, I'm calm, I'm sleeping well, no apnea, I'm having a nice dream, and keep repeating that, as I say, 4 or 5 times a day, you will reprogram your body because it thinks it's really happening, and then sleep becomes a different kind of activity for you.
Mm. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Siegel, and thank you, Professor, for putting him on your show.
All right, and give yourself credit for listening. It's, as I said, it's hard to get the men to pay attention, but when a male shows up like you, I'd say you have that potential. You're a special guy, so have faith in yourself.
Mm. Thank you so much for calling in, Yusuf. Have a good evening. All right. You know, I have to tell you, Bernie, your book is chock full of, that's my term for today, just chock full of so much wonderful, insightful information. And, you know, we can't even get to it all within a 1 hour period of time. But I encourage everyone to pick up the book because, you know, we haven't even talked about animals and how they fit into the healing process, and the paradox technique, the Siegel kit, so many gems that are embedded
in
the book.
Right.
It's a lot of great stuff in the book. If towards the end, if you could just let us know, what do you think is the most important thing for caregivers to remember?
To learn. As Joseph Campbell said, when you're going through hell, ask yourself, what am I to learn from this? When you get hungry, you seek nourishment. So when you're going through difficult times, say, what am I to learn from this? And then also seek the nourishment that you need, the care that you need. Because when you keep that balance, then things can work out. And as a caregiver, I can tell you, that helps me enormously, that if I'm getting upset, you know, as the doctor telling everybody what to do and they're not, I stop and say, what are you to learn from this? And it's always about compassion. That's what people need. And you need it for yourself, too. So when you need
that
help,
is very
ask.
True.
Right.
Wonderful. Well, you will find out about that and more if you pick up the book, The Art of Healing, Uncovering Your Inner Wisdom and Potential for Self-Healing by Dr. Bernie Siegel. And all of your other wonderful books as well are available. Now, folks can get them through Amazon?
Yes, through Amazon.
Or through your website?
They can go to my website, the Bernie Siegel MD, and order things there, sure.
Okay,
yeah,
wonderful.
And they can send notes to me through my website, too, because where it says contact us, the us is me. I mean, I deal with people,
Okay, wonderful. Well, I would like to thank you so much, Dr. Bernie Siegel, healer extraordinaire, author, visionary, and for your wonderful words this evening and your beautiful stories. And I want to invite the listeners to tune in again next month on the second Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for more Mind, Body, and Soul Food. And what we'll do is finish out the year with another author who's a spiritual teacher and an intuitive, Sarah Wiseman. Some of you may know her from The Daily Om. And she will discuss her new book, Living a Life of Gratitude, Your Journey to Grace, Joy, and Healing. And that's just what we need as we transition from one year to the next. So please join us because it's going to be delicious. And make sure to mark your calendars for 2014 because we're moving to a twice-a-month format. And we'll be running on the first and second Sundays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I invite you to visit my website, mindbodyandspiritworks.com, for more information about my holistic healing, teaching, and writing services, including my upcoming classes and events, to check out my meditation CD, which is also available on iTunes and Amazon, and to see some links for books and products and classes to support your mind, body, and spirit. Contact me on Facebook as Throat Chakra Shaman. Like the Mind, Body, and Soul Food page there, and you can sample my CD there in the store. Contact me on Twitter as Fifth Chakra Shaman, and I'm on LinkedIn. And, of course, I invite you to like my show and follow me on Blog Talk Radio. So this evening, Bernie Siegel shared his decades of wisdom as he inspired us to engage in the art of healing. For leftovers, I leave you with some mind, body, and soul food to go from Rabbi Noah Weinberg that I read in Bernie's book, The Art of Healing. And he says, buried within the subconscious and the farthest corner of our memory lies the knowledge of everything we need to know about living. So I bid you radiant health and wellness as you explore those nooks and crannies of your memories in search of this knowledge until we again dine at the mind, body, and soul food table. We hope to hear you next time.
1, 2, here I go.
Well, I'm a hungry woman. Feed me like I want to be fed.